The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're doing something a little different. We were originally planning on doing a show on the microscopic organisms that share our planet and our bodies. We spoke to Maren McKenna, author of the book Superbug, about a scary strain of drug-resistant bacteria. And we were scheduled to interview science writer Carl Zimmer about his book, A Planet of Viruses. Unfortunately, the weather conspired against us. Carl was right in the path of Hurricane Irene, and the storm knocked out his phone and electricity on the night that we were scheduled to record. Fortunately, we here at Skeptically Speaking believe in planning for contingencies. So we had a backup plan. We talked to Sean Tanner of the meteorology website Weather Underground and asked him for a crash course on hurricanes and what Irene was doing to the east coast of North America. And since we'd stumbled onto the theme of random things that can kill you, we decided to balance out the scariness by revisiting our 2010 interview with Barry Glasner, author of The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things. And by the way, Carl and his family are doing just fine. Thanks for listening. I'm here with Maren McKenna. Maren's newsroom nickname is Scary Disease Girl. She's repeatedly reported from places like a field hospital in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, a malaria hospital in Malawi, and a polio eradication team in India. She helped uncover the first cases of Gulf War syndrome and triggered the first congressional hearings on the illness. And her stories on a small town's cancer clusters helped residents win a nuclear harm lawsuit against the U.S. government. She's also the author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. Welcome to the show, Maren.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what's the difference between a regular staph infection and MRSA?
That's a great question. So the first thing I want to do is sort of unpack that acronym, MRSA, because there's a lot of information packed into it. MRSA stands for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. The SA, Staphylococcus aureus, that's the long name of what we all just call staph, the bacterium that lives on our skin and in our nostrils and causes minor infections all the time. We tend to forget that staph actually has always been, in some cases, a fairly serious infection. Back before there were antibiotics, staph infections, for instance, infections from injuries in factories or on battlefields, often did kill people, particularly if they were infections of the heart. But what makes MRSA or MRSA so serious is those other two letters, the MR, methicillin resistance. Methicillin's a drug that was invented in 1961 once staph started to become resistant to the first antibiotics, penicillin and its close cousins. You can't even buy methicillin anymore, but the reason why we still use the name is that the central chemical structure of methicillin was copied for dozens of other antibiotics, and as a result, staph is now resistant to dozens of antibiotics that we use in medicine every day. That's what MRSA or MRSA really means.
So maybe explain how MRSA enters the body and how the body responds?
Staph has probably been one of our oldest evolutionary companions. We know that because it's got so many tricks and workarounds for our immune system. And all staph, not just resistant staph, but all staph, has the unique ability to linger on our skin and in our nostrils and in other warm, damp, salty places on our bodies, and to kind of live in balance or harmony with us. Most of the time that it's there, it doesn't make us sick. But when there's a cut or a scrape or some breach in the immune protection of our skin, staph can get inside the body, can get into the bloodstream, can get into the lungs, and can cause phenomenal infections. Now, it used to be thought that in the case of MRSA, drug-resistant staff, this really happened only in hospitals. It happened to people who were very elderly or very immune-compromised or very debilitated by cancer chemotherapy or who had a lot of holes, effectively, in their skin because IVs and catheters and so forth were going in and out of them. One of the things that happened with MRSA after it first emerged is it gained some additional ability through the acquisition of some additional DNA that allows it to no longer need those cuts and breaks in the skin, but to be able to start infections wherever skin is intact. So where you get MRSA is really, in a way, kind of anywhere. It happens to be where you might have a collection of that bug on your skin.
So when was it first discovered that it wasn't just residing in hospitals?
It's a really interesting story, because the story of MRSA is really a story about how medicine resists and refuses to believe in new developments if they don't, those new developments don't fit a paradigm that everyone already believes in. MRSA, drug-resistant staph, was identified in 1961, just a couple of months after the drug methicillin was first formulated. And for a number of years, people didn't really recognize it, but eventually it was understood that MRSA was a hospital organism. Then in the mid-90s, a very smart group of clinicians at the University of Chicago noticed that they were seeing MRSA infections in children whom they were seeing in the emergency room. Now, the thing about that discovery is that an emergency room is a door that only swings one way. It swings into the hospital. You are never in a hospital and then go down to the emergency room. What that meant was that these kids had a, what everyone thought was a hospital infection, and yet had never actually been in the hospital until they walked in the door of the emergency room. The professors who recognized that had quite a long fight of a number of years to get medicine to understand and recognize that MRSA was becoming a community organism, an organism of the outside world, as much as it was a hospital organism. And in fact, now, the community epidemic of MRSA, one of the sort of three overlapping epidemics, really is much larger than the hospital epidemic ever was.
Now you say three overlapping epidemics.
Right. So first there was MRSA as a hospital organism, starting in 1961, and still a major problem today because even as more and more drugs have been brought out to defeat it and other similar drug-resistant organisms, the bacteria have gained more defenses in the way that staph has already been good at. Then from the mid-90s, there was MRSA as a community organism, recognized first in those kids on the south side of Chicago, then in athletes, in people in prisons, in people in, who live in military barracks and other very close areas, and now pretty much kind of generally distributed through the population. The third epidemic, which has gotten very little coverage and was really one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, is an epidemic of what's called livestock-associated MRSA, or for short, people call it pig MRSA, because it was actually first identified in pigs in the Netherlands. And it's a product of staph, human staph, wandering into animals that are raised in the close confinement of basically industrial-scale farming, animals that are given antibiotics routinely as they grow. That newly drug-resistant staph crossed to people who worked with the animals and moved from them into the larger population, and now it's been found throughout the European Union, in Canada, and in the United States as well, in people who work with animals, in retail meat, and now in people who have no relationship to agriculture at all.
So how did all this happen, exactly?
So all of antibiotic resistance, including MRSA, is really just a story of unintended consequences. Infectious diseases, bacteria and secondarily viruses, they're sort of mankind's oldest opponents. And when we first came up with antibiotics, which starts with Alexander Fleming's recognition in 1928 that something has contaminated one of his lab plates and that something, which turned out to be penicillium mold, was killing the staph on the plate. And we went from 1928, from that first recognition, to the mid-1940s when they actually formulated penicillin from what Fleming had found. Antibiotics were the most incredible gift. They changed the world. And they were there was so much enthusiasm for them that we completely, as a society, overused them. Penicillin wasn't everything. It wasn't cough lozenges. It wasn't face washes. It wasn't mouthwash. And as a result, bacteria took the defenses that they had always had against compounds produced by other bacteria and turned them instead to the compounds that we were now synthesizing in a laboratory and developed resistance, made themselves defenses against antibiotics. From there, from the mid-1940s, when the first drug-resistant staph is identified, it really becomes sort of the genetic equivalent of a game of whack-a-mole, where we think we're defeating the bacteria, and the bacteria pop up somewhere because they've developed a new defense, and we come up with a new drug, and the bacteria develop another defense again. We could go on like that indefinitely, except the end of the story, the last piece of the story of MRSA, is that we don't really have any new drugs anymore. Pharmaceutical companies have gotten uninterested in making antibiotics because they're a product that contains the seeds of its own destruction, including the destruction of its market, in it. So as the bacteria get more and more defenses, there are no drugs any longer to counter those defenses, and we're in a position where there are essentially untreatable infections now. We're almost back to the pre-antibiotic era.
Well, that's fairly frightening. Is this also, or can it be linked to people not taking all of their antibiotics when they are prescribed?
Yes, that's an important part of the story. I talked a few minutes ago about livestock-associated MRSA and the overuse of antibiotics in modern-day, very large-scale agriculture is a critical driver to the evolution of antibiotic resistance. But it's very important to acknowledge that human misuse or misuse in human medicine of antibiotics is also an important player. And that happens in a couple of different ways. The first is that people get antibiotics when they shouldn't have them. Something like 40% of the antibiotic prescriptions in the United States every year are written for conditions in which they won't really make a difference. They're written for viral illnesses. And that happens because a physician doesn't have enough time, or a parent doesn't have enough time in the appointment, or they pressure the doctor for a prescription. A second thing that happens is that people don't take their antibiotics very well. They borrow them from somebody else if they don't have health insurance, but they feel they need a prescription, or they feel better and so they don't take the full prescription. What all of these things do is set up conditions in the body in which it allows the bacteria to experience some drug, but not enough drug to kill it, just enough drug to stimulate the development of defenses against it. And so that human misuse added to the agricultural misuse creates this kind of perfect storm of conditions in which very resistant bacteria can emerge.
In your book, Superbug, you give a detailed history of how researchers and physicians have dealt with this throughout the years. And the stories are often gruesome or infuriating. They alternate. Are there any of those stories that really particularly stuck with you?
There are so many narratives in the story of MRSA that just kind of broke my heart. And
right.
And people have told me that this book, I appreciate you saying it's fascinating and infuriating. You know, a lot of these stories are really quite tragic. There are a lot of dead children or very gravely ill children in my book, as much as there are people who are quite heroic in trying to counter this. The story that really sticks with me is a story that actually starts the book. It's the story of a kid named Tony Love. He's a preteen. He lives on the south side of Chicago. He lived with his mom and his grandmother and his younger siblings, and he was just a very average kid who wasn't very interested in school. He really loved sports. You know, he just was having a very average childhood. And then one day he banged into another kid in gym class, and he got a scratch, and they looked at it, and they thought it was no big deal, and he just went on living his life. And then just a couple of days later, he started to feel unwell. They took him to the hospital. Nothing seemed very wrong. He continued to be unwell. They took him to the hospital again, and he collapsed. And it turned out that he had an infection with the community strain of MRSA that just in those few days, just a week or two, had seeded itself through his body. He had major abscesses in almost every joint in his body. And at the point at which this was discovered, he was pretty close to death. He was sliding into septic shock. They, the physicians, he happened to be treated at University of Chicago, which is where I met him when I was talking to the researchers there. They had to drain abscesses in the joints of his fingers, in the palm of his hand, in his hips and his knees and his elbows. And his care went on for months. By the time he was done, he did recover. He was mostly better, except that one lingering infection in the long bone of his thigh had caused them to have to drill the bone out from the inside repeatedly to get that infection out. And as a result, he was left with a permanently weakened leg. He was a kid who loved sports, and he came from a relatively poor neighborhood in which sports stars are not only people that are really looked up to, but sports is thought of as the way for a kid to get out of a neighborhood like that. And he had planned on a life playing sports, and this infection may have taken that plan away from him.
So what I'm saying to you, audience, is this is a fantastic book. Do not read it while you eat. So do you think that there is a solution for MRSA?
You know, I want to believe so. But the reality is that MRSA and other forms of drug resistance, they're a slow drip problem, what a public health person would call a multifactorial problem. Lots of things contributed to this. And it's going to take action on a lot of fronts for us to be able to roll it back. The problem is that, like climate change, for instance, any one thing that you can do feels so small that it's hard to believe that you're actually going to make a difference. But the reality is there are things that we can do sort of on two levels. There are things that we can do to be personally protective, to take care of ourselves and our loved ones and our households. And then there are things that we have to ask our institutions to do for us because they are not under our control. People can protect themselves by doing something as simple as washing their hands rigorously, because our hands and our fingers are what transfer the bug in our environment to the most vulnerable parts of our body. And if you believe, and I think you should, that the way that we raise animals in agriculture plays a role in this, then you can do things like voting with your dollars or whatever currency you spend and not buying meat that's raised with antibiotics, because not only does that contribute to the larger problem, but the drug-resistant organisms may actually be on the meat that you buy. There are other things that have to be done that are not in our control, from asking governments to do a better job of counting and tracking this bug to backing research, particularly into new antibiotics and possibly into a vaccine, to doing things like changing the way we overuse antibiotics, both in human medicine and in agriculture. It's going to take action on all of those fronts to actually make a dent in this. But there are those few things that we can do to protect ourselves while the larger wave, we hope, is being rolled back.
Now, being that you're a scary disease girl, where does MRSA stack up compared to the other diseases that you've looked at?
You know, it's a funny thing. I mean, I have been writing about emerging infections for quite a while, and it's odd to find that the things that are actually the greatest danger to us, realistically speaking, in our daily lives, are not actually the things that frighten people the most. And they're often not the things that people want to read about. People are fascinated by things like Ebola. So I live in Atlanta. There has never been a case of Ebola in the United States. There have only been a few cases of viral hemorrhagic fevers, period. A few of them have been imported from Africa, but they've never been passed to anyone else, and the same thing has happened in Canada, too. Yet people are fascinated by those. They can't get enough of them. It's actually quite hard to get people to focus on things like, for instance, hospital-acquired infections, such as MRSA. Those are a much more present risk to us, and yet they're somehow prosaic for people, and they're not exciting, which is one reason why I wrote this book. I thought when I was reporting on this book, which took several years, that MRSA was the most frightening thing I could think of because it's everywhere. But I think I've actually changed my mind now. There's actually a more frightening type of drug-resistant bacteria, which are collectively called the drug-resistant gram-negatives. They're referred to with acronyms like CRKP and NDM1, and there are a few drugs that still work against MRSA, against the most resistant gram-negatives, which tend to be mostly but not entirely in hospitals, there's nothing. They are not susceptible to any drug that's left. In them, we really are back to the pre-antibiotic era. Those really scare me.
I will have to have you on to talk about that the next time I want to be terrified. Thanks very much for being here, Maren.
Thank you, and thanks to your audience. I very much appreciate the time.
You can find a link to Maren McKenna, author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Sean Tanner of the weather resource site Weather Underground after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Sean Tanner. Sean is the head of meteorological operations at the meteorology resource site Weather Underground. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Sean.
Hello.
So maybe let's start talking about hurricanes as a phenomenon. So how exactly do they form?
Well, before you get into how they form, you have to know where they form. There's one main ingredient and a lot of smaller ingredients that hurricanes need in order to come to life. And the main ingredient is warm water. So in order for hurricanes to come to life, they have to have warm water and therefore have to be in the tropics. That's the first main thing. You need to have water in excess of 80 degrees Fahrenheit to get a hurricane developing. The next thing you need is something called convergence. I want you to think of convergence kind of like a traffic jam where you got cars piling up. Instead of in the atmosphere, when you have convergence, you get piling up vertically. And whenever you get that going on, you get thunderstorms. Rising air creates clouds. You can go back to your intro to science class, intro
right.
to meteorology class. Rising air makes clouds, cools and condenses and makes clouds. Then you get into what's called latent heat, which I'm not going to get into that, but basically the thunderstorm kind of acts like a heat engine where it takes the energy from the warm water of the ocean and transports it up high into the atmosphere and eventually radiates it way up into the atmosphere and kind of gets rid of it. So it acts very much like a heat engine where it's taking the heat down at the surface and putting it up in the atmosphere, which is why you need a very warm surface water. The other main ingredient you need is what's called low wind shear. You think of it like shearing paper, right, where you're pulling paper in opposite directions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wind shear is the same way, and thunderstorms don't like wind shear. They're not a fan. Because what wind shear does is it tends to tip a thunderstorm and a hurricane on its side. You've probably never seen a thunderstorm or a hurricane that's tipped on its side because they don't exist. When that happens, they tend to break down. So that's what the tropics gives you. It gives you warm water, gives you convergence, and then it gives you low wind shear.
Well, hurricanes are generally quite big. So how does that organized spiral shape happen over such a large area?
Some hurricanes aren't that big. I mean, some are quite tiny. It just so happens that the one that hit the East Coast over the last couple of days, Irene, was huge. Some can be 50, 60 miles across, and some can be 1,000 miles across. So it just depends. Again, how it gets organized like that is it's all about rising motion of the atmosphere. The more rising motion you get, the bigger the storm's going to be.
Well, what about the paths that they take? What determines sort of where a hurricane will hit or miss?
There's something in the atmosphere that us meteorologists like to call steering currents. We like to name things appropriately. I mean, don't make it more difficult than it is. It's a current in the air that's steering the hurricane in a direction. And one of the steering mechanisms in the atmosphere is what's called a high pressure system. And we even name it even more. We call it Bermuda high pressure system. And again, don't make it more difficult than it is. It's over Bermuda. That high pressure system will spin clockwise. So if you can imagine in your head, you got a clockwise spinning circulation going on. So on the left side of that high, that wind is going from south to north. So that's your steering current. So when the hurricane comes around that side of the high, it's going to be pushed to the north. And that's why you see a lot of hurricanes when they're in the Atlantic Ocean. They take a kind of a western course. They go from east to west, and then they start to curve north and eventually go northeast. And that's because they're going on the west side of that high pressure system, the Bermuda High.
Oh, interesting. So that always happens?
Not always. Some storms tend to stay down in the tropics longer than other storms. And some storms will immediately take that northward movement called a recurve. We call it a recurve motion. They'll take it almost immediately when they're born. It all depends on where that high pressure system is.
What kind of methods do you guys use to measure and track hurricanes?
There's a lot of things, actually. So you have one of the most important things is satellites. Before we had the invention of satellites, we really didn't know where these hurricanes were. The only way we knew a hurricane was in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean was if a ship went through it. And then a ship could relay the message that, hey, I just went through a hurricane. And then several decades ago, they plotted it on these maps. So satellites are a huge bonus in the modern age. We always know where the hurricane is, basically. The second thing we use is when a hurricane gets going, we have a hurricane hunter aircrafts. Now, these are people who literally fly through hurricanes, and they drop very expensive equipment that we'll never see again into the middle of hurricanes. And all that stuff sends back weather data to the National Hurricane Center, and they can make better predictions of that. So these people, that's their job, is to fly through hurricanes. I mean, how cool of a job is that?
That's a different definition of cool, sir.
Well, our chief meteorologist at Weather Underground actually flew through Hurricane Hugo, which is one of the strongest storms ever recorded. And the plane actually almost crashed in the middle of the storm because the storm was much stronger than they anticipated. Buoys. We also use buoys. So if a hurricane will go across the buoy in the middle of the ocean, that'll be a major bonus because now we have the exact pinpoint of the intensity and the placement of the hurricane. Hmm. Also, if a hurricane goes over land, like the small islands of the Caribbean Sea, if a hurricane goes over that land, we can have precise movement characterizations of the hurricanes.
What do the categories mean?
All it means is it categorizes based on wind speed. Category 1 is the lowest, starts at 74 miles an hour, and then Category 5 is the highest. Category 5 means that it has sustained wind speeds of 156 miles an hour plus. Keep in mind, that's sustained wind speeds. That's not wind gusts. So you have to have wind blowing 74 miles an hour for an extended period of time
right,
in order for a storm to be considered a hurricane.
And that can be upgraded or downgraded.
Yeah. For instance, Irene was a Category 3 at one point, but at landfall, it was a Category 1.
So what would you say that the most damaging aspect of a hurricane is then?
Overall, it depends on where you live. Because if you're inland, away from the ocean, it's going to be the wind. But if you're near the coast, by far the most damaging, and this is true monetarily too, by far the most damaging is what's called storm surge. Here's another imagery for you. You're sitting in your bathtub, taking a nice warm bath, and let's say you were to blow across the water. What's going to happen is that water is going to be pushed towards the opposite end of the bathtub. And the harder you blow, the more water is going to be pushed against the far end. The hurricanes act the same way. You get wind that pushes against the water and hits land. It's going to pile up on that land because it has nowhere else to go. If it gets big enough, it'll top storm walls, it'll push inland, and it'll create a lot of havoc for the people who live right on the coast. So that's the number one aspect that hurricanes bring. Monetarily, it's consistently the most damaging part of the hurricane.
I don't mean to cast aspersions on your profession, sir, but how about making predictions about the strength of a storm? How do you do that?
It's all about models. And we're not talking about runway models or anything like that. What we're talking about is what are called atmospheric models. They're very, very, very complex models that use a ton of mathematical computations that no one could ever do in their right mind by hand. It's all done by computers. So basically you get one model will say one thing, another atmospheric model will say another, a third will say a completely different thing. And that's where meteorologists come in and say, model A is completely out to lunch, it's wrong. Let's get these other models together and get a consensus going on here. to predict the future, you got to have models in hand. You also have to have knowledge and experience, and that's where the National Hurricane Center comes in. They have such an in-depth knowledge of hurricanes that it's just incredible.
How would they figure out the path then? Is it the same thing? Is that they build models?
So basically, all the model's doing is it's giving you an opinion of where the storm will be in 24 hours or so. If, for instance, yesterday, Model A said it was going to be in spot A, but in fact it was 150 miles to the east, you know that you're not going to pay attention to Model A very much in the future because it's been wrong before. And then we can go back, right? Now we can say that it also depends on where that Bermuda high pressure system is, where we talked about it before. If the model has the high pressure system correctly placed, then that model, whatever model it is more likely to be correct.
You're listening to a special interview on Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Sean Tanner, head of meteorological operations at the Weather Underground. Now, I have an audience question by email from the other Irene.
How big does a storm have to get before they give it a name? And who decides what to call it?
They get names as soon as they're tropical storm strength. So you have your categories, category 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Tropical storm is one notch below that. So you have tropical storm and then category 1. And that's when they get their name, as soon as they reach tropical storm status. Now, the second part of the question, how they get their names. It used to be that they were named by coordinate. So this one's at 34 latitude, 123 west longitude. And then they decided to name them all female names. This is before the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
We all know what happened in the 60s. You had the feminist movement. And the feminist movement, probably rightfully so, did not appreciate all the feminine names being taken for these violent storms. I think it was 1978 and 1979, they switched to alternating male and female names.
Right.
So this year we had Arlene was the first one. Next year the A name will be a male name. But then they alternate within the year, too. So Irene is the I, and then we have Jose, that's actually currently out in the Atlantic Ocean, is the next tropical storm, so it's alphabetical. They have six lists that rotate by year. So 2011, we had the same list as we had in 2005. And 2005 was, of course, the Hurricane Katrina year.
Who decides, though, what to call it?
Family members at the National Hurricane Center.
I mean, interesting.
That's almost literally how it happens. Someone will just nominate a name, and then they'll get through a consensus that okay, we'll use that name. For instance, the K name for this year is Katia. Now you might think, shouldn't it be Katrina again because we're on that same list? But in fact, Katrina was such a strong storm that it's been retired. You'll never see another Hurricane Katrina. So they had to think of another K name. And the K name this year, for whatever reason, is Katia.
And we have a question from Lisa via email.
What was the most damaging hurricane ever recorded?
Hurricane Katrina was by far the number one, 2005. I mean, it only made landfall near New Orleans, not even at New Orleans, to the east of New Orleans, as a Category 3 hurricane. So it was two notches below the highest. But again, Category 3 hurricanes, not necessarily looking at the wind speed. You're looking at the storm surge that the Category 3 hurricane can cause. New Orleans is in such a weird location. It's actually below sea level for a lot of the city. So it's lower than the Gulf of Mexico, and it's also lower than what's called Lake Pontchartrain. So you have two areas that were flooding into New Orleans on that day, and that's why it was so expensive and such a disaster.
We have a lot of email questions here. One from Willow.
Why are the Atlantic storms called hurricanes and Pacific storms called cyclones? Where did these words come from?
It's the age-old question. They're actually the same thing. It's just they're in different parts of the world. So in the Western Pacific Ocean, now this is hard to imagine because we think of ourselves as the western part of the planet, but the Western Pacific Ocean is by Taiwan and China. The hurricanes, quote-unquote, that form over there are actually called typhoons. So when you hear in the media that typhoon such-and-such is about to hit China or Taiwan, it's just a different name. They're the same thing as the hurricanes. They form the same way. They're just called typhoons. There's actually a typhoon very near Taiwan right now. It's a Category 1 typhoon called Nan Madal, and it's about to hit Taiwan. Our news media just doesn't cover it too much because it's on the other side of the planet.
Right.
the Indian Ocean, they have cyclones. They're called cyclones. So you get completely mixed up. Indian Ocean is cyclones. Western Pacific Ocean is typhoons. And then Eastern Pacific and Atlantic Ocean is hurricanes. It's all very confusing.
Let's talk about some more current events there. We might as well talk about Irene now. I realize that probably as we speak, Irene is still winding her way up the east coast of North America. But what have we learned now so far? How strong did Irene wind up at her peak? Do we say her?
You can say her. Okay. I usually say it. Semantics, right? Doesn't matter too much. Because the next storm will be a he, and then everybody will be fine with it. So at its peak, it was a Category 3 hurricane, I think with winds of 120 miles an hour. At that time, it was in the Bahamas. So it had to track all the way through the Bahamas. It went across the Gulf Stream, and then it weakened as it approached North Carolina in the United States. It actually made three landfalls. I'm going to confuse everybody now. The first landfall was at North Carolina. It had a 90-mile-per-hour wind gust. So that's a Category 1 hurricane. The second landfall was on New Jersey, on the coast of New Jersey, at a place called Little Egg Inlet, as a Category 1 hurricane, 75 miles an hour. And then the third landfall was on Long Island near New York, and it was a tropical storm at that point, so it weakened to 65 miles an hour.
So how closely did that match the predictions that were made?
You know, I got to say, the National Hurricane Center did a fantastic job at pinpointing the track of this thing several days in advance. Once you got close to North Carolina, they were a little off on the intensity of it. So the category, they had it stronger than what it might actually be. But at that point, as it's approaching North Carolina, you don't really care too much about the category. It's all semantics at that point. You care where it's going to affect. The models they used, the reasoning the National Hurricane Center used was fabulous.
So at this point, do we have any idea really how much damage the storm did?
You're still waiting because there's still a ton of people, and by a ton, I mean hundreds of thousands most likely, without power. And that's just going to add to the damages. A lot of people were evacuated from low-lying areas of New York. I'm not sure if that gets added to the official tally of damages because you actually had to physically take the people who are incapable of moving themselves. You have to move them out. So that gets added to quote-unquote damages. I'm not necessarily sure that that's true. But it's more than likely that this storm is going to be yet another billion-dollar disaster in the United States for this year. And I think that will make the number 10. So we'd have 10 billion-dollar disasters this year, which would set a record.
So did the East Coast get lucky with this one overall then, or did the media blow it out of proportion? Because I've been reading a lot of blog posts today saying there was a lot of trouble for nothing.
Well, can't that be both true?
Indeed.
I think of the media and the media outlets as a business. So they're constantly competing for attention. So it's almost in their business architecture to blow things out of proportion. At Weather Underground, we took a more measured approach. We were literally tweeting minute by minute for 2 days straight. I've been up for 2 days straight tweeting about Irene, and it was more factual based.
Right.
So yes, did the Northeast catch a break? Yes, they did, because a Category 5 hurricane didn't hit you. But they still had flooding. You still had what I think 14 deaths so far have been related to Irene. So you can only say that the media overhyped this thing. That's only true for a certain amount of space, right? Because 14 people died. That's still a disaster.
And we have another question from Blinky via email.
What's the most important thing that a person can do to prepare for a hurricane?
Very servicey.
Yeah, so be knowledgeable. Know if the hurricane's going to hit your area. That's the first step. Is a hurricane going to hit me? The second step is, what are my officials telling me? Are my city officials telling me, get the heck out of my town? You need to move away from the coast. If they are, get the heck out of town. Go inland. Have a nice vacation for the weekend. Just go do something else. And then when you come back, you're still going to be alive. The third thing actually is prepare yourself in case you do get hit by a hurricane and you are at home. Here on the West Coast, we have earthquake stashes, which by the way, while I was tweeting and updating everybody, we had a 4.8 earthquake right underneath my house, which is kind of interesting. So, but we have to prepare ourselves. So you should prepare yourself too. You have to prepare yourselves in case you're out of power for several days. That includes not only you, but your pets. and any medications that you need. Just be prepared. That's the old scout oath, right?
But how does somebody discriminate between sort of the more hyperbolic kind of media portrayal of the potential of a hurricane and something that is fact-based? Is there any way to remain calm, I guess, in a, you know, a charged environment like this?
I don't know if there's any way to stay calm if your city official or your mayor is saying, leave, you know?
Yeah.
How can you stay calm when someone's doing that? Of course, mandatory evacuations are always in quotes, right? Mandatory. Mm-hmm. They're not going to force you from your home.
Right. Bloomberg did say that it wasn't being enforced.
It wasn't being enforced, although Governor Christie in New Jersey basically yelled at people on the beach to get the heck off the beach. But he can't enforce it. It's an individual opinion.
Right.
But history can repeat itself. New Orleans was evacuated too late, and then look what happened there. I mean, there's thousands of deaths. Do you really want to die because of a hurricane? If not, then just heed warnings and get the heck out of your city.
I think that's good advice. Thanks very much for being here, Sean.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be right back to wrap up our hour on random things that can kill you with an excerpt from our interview with Barry Glasner, author of The Culture of Fear.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the molecules around us, from the most simple to the most complex. Guest host Rochelle Saunders gets a tour of the periodic table from science writer Sam Keen, who joins us to talk about his book, The Disappearing Spoon, and other true tales of madness, love, and the history of the world from the periodic table of the elements. And we'll learn about cutting-edge research into light-bending metamaterials with David R. Smith, director for the Center of Metamaterials and Integrated Plasmonics at Duke University. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Today I'm speaking with Barry Glasner, the author of 7 books on contemporary social issues, one of them being the national bestseller, The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things. So this is not simply about people getting a bit freaked out. The term culture of fear is a pervasive and rather overwhelming anxiety.
In North America, most people live in about the safest places and about the safest times in human history. And yet, so many people are afraid of so many things that they don't really need to be afraid of. Fears are either very much overblown or almost completely unfounded. How does that happen? And why does it happen? Who benefits? Who pays for it? Usually it's politicians who are trying to stay in office or win elections by fear-mongering. It's advocacy groups that make their money and get memberships and keep their members engaged by fears and scares that horrible things are about to happen or will happen if their organization isn't predominant. And then certain sorts of media outlets that we can talk about more blank.
Well, let's talk about some of the tactics. Now, you mentioned the media. I guess the most stark example to me is the Halloween candy.
Yeah, which was a story that was told for a long time. And a sociologist named Joel Best is the person who utterly debunked it by looking at pretty much every case reported and discovering that either it didn't happen or it was mistold or it was really something that was planned. It was a prank that was intentional, not always a prank. Sometimes it was quite malicious. But there were very, very few of them, and none of them matched the description in the report. I mean, if you would turn on local TV news, they'd be at the emergency room with the latest cases of razor blade and an apple.
So this is an example of one of those bad things which are presented as possible, but they really aren't terribly likely. But they're treated as imminent or looming threats.
Even though it was propagated very much by contemporary media, I would still call that an urban legend. I think it fits with the research on urban legend, which I'm very interested in, but I'm more interested in the sorts of fears and scares that are manipulated or set up and perpetuated by particular groups, particular organizations or interests for their own self-interest and are promoted widely. For example, one I am very interested in is kidnapped children. If you look at the coverage of kidnapped children, it's just persistent. I mean, you can't go very long on cable TV news in the U.S. without stories of kidnapped children. And the notion that is conveyed is that, and this is something that every parent should worry about, and a lot of the coverage over the years, you get really extreme statements made that are just highly inaccurate and not necessarily just by fringe speakers in the media, either by people from advocacy groups that are concerned about this sort of thing. I talk in the new edition of the book of TV news channels talking about 100,000 abductions of strangers every year in the United States. That's actually a direct quote from Bill O'Reilly on his,
right.
on his program. But you get numbers like that thrown around a lot. And the actual number that year he was talking, according to the U.S. Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention that keeps track of these things, the actual number was 115 cases of so-called stereotypical kidnappings by non-family members held for a long time or murdered. These kinds of numbers thrown around has a big impact, obviously, on people watching, parents and so forth. And while I think it would be impossible to demonstrate a direct causal relationship, there have been considerable parental restrictions on children's activity as a result of these fears and related fears.
Well, you mentioned causal effects, and there's a lot of examples in your book of people confusing correlation with causation.
That's one of the common ways that these fears and scares get going, is to say the two things are associated. And it's not that hard to come up with a correlation between two things if you manipulate the data, or even if you don't, if you just do enough runs, you're going to get something. And so any politician trying to sell any kind of program, any advocacy group that works at it very hard can do this. And that's one of the main techniques for fear-mongering, along with some others. I'm particularly interested in some that have to do with the kind of storytelling that goes on as well. You know, the use of anecdotes to replace actual evidence is probably what I have found most common in the fear-mongering that I've studied most closely. In this new edition that came out this year of The Culture of Fear, I looked again at something I'd looked at last time, which is scares about vaccines. And this round, the use of dramatic examples of compelling people, usually so-called vaccine-injured children, was a very important part of that way of telling that story.
Maybe you could go back a bit and sort of explain how the vaccine issue happened in the first place.
It goes back to the 80s and to the scares about the diphtheria, that pertussis shot. And basically what happened was there was a particular person, a woman who was a very effective advocate. She started advocating for this. She managed to get extraordinary publicity. And really what launched the whole scare in a big way was an NBC News special. And in that special, there were children who were said to have been damaged by whooping cough vaccine. And they were shown in very sad state, which then made a very dramatic point. This advocacy group, which named itself Dissatisfied Parents Together, or DPT, received a huge number of phone calls, memberships from this program, and it grew on itself. Before long, you had, of course, class action lawsuits. And then after a while, as I describe in some detail in the book, the manufacturers were getting out of business and there was a shortage of vaccine. If we flash forward now to the current period, and just very recently as well, lots of studies have shown a significant increase in the number of cases of whooping cough. And the risk of pertussis or whooping cough is about six times higher in unvaccinated children. So it's not surprising that that would happen.
So what you talk about in your book, there's also a focus on bringing out the manageable but not significant issues instead of the larger societal issues that we should be focusing on.
My argument is not that there's nothing to be afraid of, but we certainly can rationally ask the question, what would it make more sense to be fearful about? And in terms of social issues and social problems, it seems to me that it's not that hard to decide how to answer the question. It's a reasonably large sector of the population susceptible to some serious, potentially negative consequence. There are many areas, of course, where that's true. So I focus a lot in the book about scares relating to children. We talked a few minutes ago about scares about kidnapped kids. But this is at a time when public schools are truly crumbling. I don't mean that metaphorically in cases. They're understaffed. Many children don't have basic nutrition for all or part of the month. We can go on and on about those kinds of dangers. They get relatively little attention in the media and political discourse. We end up with a lot of misdirection in major cultural and social discussion by people who have an interest for one reason or another in distracting attention away from other problems.
Well, give me an example of one of those reasons that people would want to misdirect away from a larger societal issue.
A particularly common example is in politics. If I'm running for election and I am not going to be able to propose solutions to the large problem, if I can get them focused on a problem that I can address and get them very fearful about it and suggest to them that if they elect me, the problem will be reduced or go away, I'm in a great shape. And this is done all the time with crime scares. You're afraid of this, I'm going to get tough on it, and I'm going to do something that will have a big dramatic effect. And if you look at a lot of this legislation that's passed, you'll find that that's how it came about.
So now all of these stories were presented with all of these horrific but potentially statistically insignificant actions in the news and in the newspapers and from our family and friends. So what are the repercussions of this?
One repercussion is we talk about them all the time, you know, with each other, which then makes us even more afraid. It makes great conversation. In our conversation today, we've been talking mostly about formal settings, political campaigns, and the media, and so forth. But it also takes place person to person in a family and neighborhood gathering. And there, it's kind of entertainment. What I find interesting about that is that that's the case also in these more formal cases that I've studied so much. Why does it work for a politician to get votes? Why does it work for TV news channel to get ratings? Because they have high level of drama to them. The narrative is very compelling.
With health issues, when stories are covered in a way that it seems like if you get cancer, it is a death sentence, what are the consequences of that?
As we know, people stay away from people with cancer almost like it's communicable. And that's a response that a lot of folks have in that kind of situation. And also, for people who may be experiencing a symptom, if you're sufficiently fearful that the consequences are going to be death, a reasonable thing to do is to not find out. The biggest danger for the individual from this kind of exaggerated sense of danger and a lack of understanding of what the actual possibilities or odds are is to avoid getting the kind of treatment or prevention that could actually be quite beneficial. That's where the paradox of this phenomenon.
It also seems like the pseudo-dangers are frightening people away from actually taking part in real life as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's really good research on this, especially with regard to older people. The elderly who routinely watch these scary stories on local TV news and elsewhere stay inside more, get less exercise. That, if you think about it, isn't very surprising. You see these scary things, why would you go out, especially if you feel vulnerable because, you know, you're not as physically strong as you were at one time or you don't respond as fast as you did? You're going to have that kind of reaction. In the case of scares about crime broadly and dangers to children everywhere you turn, that has certainly influenced parents to keep their children less active. What might be more controversial is how well we can relate that to other outcomes, such as increased weight among children, so-called childhood obesity and such. But restrictions on activity, it would seem reasonable, at least to hypothesize, that has something to do with those other negative outcomes.
And we have a question from the chat room.
Do you consider fear-mongering over terrorism to be a subset of fear-mongering over crime, or is it a distinct phenomenon?
Before September 11, 2001, the basic narrative of fear in the U.S. especially, in North America broadly, goes something like this. There are monsters among us, what I call the sick society narrative. The scares were about adolescent males, mostly. This notion of the super predator young adolescent in cities and in suburbs. There were a lot of scares about adolescent mothers, claims that pregnant teenagers were destroying the country and wrecking the economy and such. So after 9/11, 2001, that narrative pretty quickly shifted to foreign terrorists want to destroy us. And that is a shift that has very significant outcomes for certain people. For example, for adolescent males, they're no longer, since 9/11, the focus of a lot of the fear-mongering. And on the flip side of that, who is? Well, people who are perceived as foreign, especially Middle Eastern, and people from a variety of ethnic and national groups. And that kind of collective fear coalesced pretty quickly, but then had all kinds of other ramifications. In the U.S., there was, and of course continues to be, a whole system of perpetual fear-mongering that takes a variety of forms. And so this shift in the basic fear narrative has been pretty profound.
And we have a question from the chat room.
When can fear be a positive motivator? When should we trust our own fears?
When there's real danger. You know, if that sounds too simple, I actually don't think it is. You need to assess whether what you're fearful of has a reasonable probability based on good evidence. So, for example, am I going to be concerned about the airplane flight I'm about to take? You know, a lot of people are fearful because of all kinds of scary stories about airline crashes. And what happens when there are a lot of those stories at once is people stop flying as much. For shorter trips, they're more likely to take cars and therefore are more likely to die or be seriously injured in a car accident than they would be if they took the airline flight. So, you know, what I think we need to say to ourselves is, have we gotten afraid of something that is then making us behave in an actually more dangerous way? And the flip side of that is, how do we know when the opposite is true? Well, when there are actual dangers around that we're not paying attention to or that we're ignoring conveniently. People who avoid kinds of preventive medical tests because they don't want to hear the news is a great example. I mentioned earlier one that I think is a really important one to keep in mind right now, and that is getting children vaccinated and not being susceptible to the very widespread fear and scare campaigns about vaccination. And then I think we're able to conduct our lives in ways that are not only more reasonable, but a lot safer.
So can widespread publicity of reassuring real statistics, can they ever really compete with any of the media about the pseudo-dangers?
I'm of two minds about that. In my research, I was really reassured a lot by how often it was that journalists, they were the ones who debunked these fears and scares. And so encouraging more of that can have a big effect. Crack babies is one example of that. Media themselves that had been engaged in really intense fear-mongering about these children just flipped it over and debunked them, and that scare pretty much disappeared. That's just one example. So on the one hand, yeah, I'm really encouraged. When I say I'm of two minds, what I mean is it doesn't happen very much, and fears and scares that are blown out of proportion continue for long periods of time, and it's very hard for people who are busy with other things, you know, they have their lives and their own work, to sort them out. But what I always tell people about that is it's not as hard as you think. For many that we've talked about during this program, for instance, all you need is a little basic knowledge of where to find the reality to be able to check these things out yourself. You know, if you hear that some vaccine is terribly dangerous, go see what the pediatric societies are saying about it. They actually know. They are able to cite very reliable research and tell you what the actual danger is. You can find that online in about 3 minutes.
And then would you suggest, once you find out the real statistics and the real information, that you start your own counter campaign?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that you talk back to the groups that are providing the fears and scares. My main advice about politicians is I will never vote for someone who engages in a fear campaign, even if I like everything else they're doing.
Thanks very much for being here, Barry.
Thanks for having me on.
And for more of Barry, visit barryglassner.com. And for more of us, visit skepticallyspeaking.com. There you will find all the links you need to our Facebook page, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant.
The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.